Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. We own the Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we are here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, or reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francisco.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing really well. Doing real well. How about you?
I'm doing just grand. Summer is upon us.
Yeah, what do you want to talk about today?
Can we talk briefly about a little pet peeve of mine?
I don't think you can talk briefly about anything, Francis. I've known you a really long time. Brevity, not really something you do so well.
Not really my forte. However, iced coffee.
Okay.
I don't understand something about iced coffee.
The ice or the coffee?
If we go out and say you buy a hot coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I buy an iced coffee.
Yes.
Why does mine cost a dollar more than yours?
Because
ice is not that expensive, I know.
It's very, very labor-intensive.
No, I don't get that one.
Is it, I don't know.
Can I share with you the next pet peeve?
Because it's garbage.
Can I share with you the next pet peeve of mine?
Go ahead.
When you make an iced coffee, all you restaurant folks out there making your shortcuts, same as with an iced tea.
Mm-hmm.
If you take hot tea or hot coffee and simply put ice in it.
Yeah.
You have made an awful diluted beverage.
Yes, you
not
have.
Not diluted, but diluted beverage, and I don't really care much for that at all.
Yeah, that's because you're diluted.
What you want to do is make a hot coffee and then cool it in the refrigerator. And here's a little trick for you folks at home and even you bartenders out there and you waiters who get caught short and you didn't make any iced coffee and somebody wants one. If you take one of those metal
shaker cups
like you make a martini with, and you put your coffee in there and then you put that in the ice bin and swirl it around and stir it a little bit without you're not putting any ice in the coffee, and then you chill the coffee down that way and then you pour it over ice, you will have an iced coffee or an iced tea. It's all about melt rate.
Francis, why wouldn't you put just it right in the glass and put the glass in the ice?
because that would be very dangerous because you'd have a broken, cracked glass.
Oh, okay, good. Well, you know, actually, I have a little pet peeve about that, too, because I go to restaurants sometimes.
Yeah.
And I ask them if they have iced tea, like fresh brewed iced tea.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently I'll get a no.
Mm-hmm.
To which I respond, do you have hot tea?
Right. Do you have ice? No.
But seriously, I mean, frequently I've had to say, okay, can I have a hot tea, please, then? Okay. Can I have a large glass of ice?
Yeah,
okay.
But then you have to dilute it.
Yeah, and I end up having a diluted iced tea. You're absolutely right.
But
it's just not that hard. The whole instant tea thing, boiling water is the only step to making tea.
Yeah.
So why do we have to have instant tea?
Well, and the other thing is I would like to speak to everyone about sun tea. Sun tea, my mother thought it was a great invention, big thing. We'd put the big jug of water in the sun mm-hmm. with tea bags in it. Okay.
The sun's very powerful.
Yeah, but it's not very good at making iced tea. Okay. Putting tea bags in,
we never did that. I got to tell you, we just never did.
God. Yeah, I mean, what happens is you extract the tannic acid, and so you get the bitterness of tea, but you don't get any of the flavor of tea.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how you make a really great iced tea? And people don't realize how great iced tea can be.
Mm-hmm.
You make a really great pot of tea. And
right.
then you chill it, and then you ice it, and you can have, really, iced tea is a very flavorful and complex beverage.
Yep.
I mean, it can be really great.
I mean, I make iced tea from real tea every day at my house.
Well, and when we talk about real tea, let's be honest, the tea, if you're buying Lipton tea bags, and say you like to have a cup of tea, you know, my grandmother would drink Lipton tea, my grandmother, my mother's mom, Nana, we would go out to lunch, and she would either bring her own tea bag. And, of course, my grandmother had lost her house in the Depression. They were very frugal people.
Right.
Very generous people, but very frugal people about their own needs and wants. And I remember my grandmother, she would recycle the Lipton tea bag.
So
you know,
reuse the same tea bag
oh,
twice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sounds delicious.
No, I mean, at home, she'd make a cup of tea and then, put it in the cupboard for later when she would have another cup of tea.
Are you kidding?
No. Hey, you know, people who live through the Depression, they have a very different sensibility about all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, Francis, and I know you know this because we have some teas at the restaurant, that actually get better with their second and third and fourth infusion.
Oolong
so,
tea.
So we have some oolongs, and even our White Tip Earl Grey, you can infuse two times. If you're using really, really high-quality teas, each batch of tea will be a little bit different than the other batch, and frankly, with our oolong tea, I tend to like the second and third batch better than the first batch.
What Mark is talking about is the second, like you make a cup of tea from it or a pot of tea, and then when you're done with it, you make another pot of tea from the same tea leaves and have a second infusion. And with oolong tea, that's traditional, and each infusion has a slightly different flavor. And I prefer the second and third infusions from oolong as well. Listen, if you're making iced tea at home, if you're making tea at home, and I think summer, again, you want to amaze your guests, make some really nice tea. And tea's not cheap, but it's not crazy expensive.
Right.
And
especially, I mean, the oolong tea is very expensive, but if you consider that you can make seven pots with the same batch of leaves, it's less expensive than a bag of Lipton.
A way to amaze your guests in the summertime and a way to really delight yourself is to make an iced tea in the proper way.
And I do love to amaze my guests and delight myself, Francis.
Funny. It's so hard not to delight yourself. But here's the deal. If you're making tea from a tea bag, even if it's like a Twinings tea bag, you're making tea from tea sawdust.
Right. The lowest quality of tea that hits the market goes into the regular bags.
And making a cup of tea, or whether it's iced or hot, from individual tea leaves, and that, yeah, if you want to go to the market, Twinings loose tea leaves are pretty good, actually.
Certainly a big step above the bags.
Monstrous. And then when you go into specialty tea shops, and remember, you don't use a lot of tea in each pot of tea or cup of tea, to make really great tea. Very remarkable, very wonderful, and then to make iced tea from it, really great. I just came back from Ireland where, you know, you go over to someone's house, they offer you tea. You know, it's the thing you offer people when they come over your house, you know.
I do that in Cranford, France.
Well, you know, maybe you're part Irish, lucky boy. I don't think so.
I think not.
But when you make someone a cup of tea, the thing about tea is it has to be fresh. And you make a cup of tea, and it has a life. And shortly after it's made, for a little while after it's made, it's a very delightful beverage. Now, if you put that in the refrigerator and use it later, it's still good for a while. But nothing is like when you make a hot cup of tea fresh, and also if you make iced tea and use it within the hour or something like that, it really is a remarkable beverage. And tea and coffee sometimes can approach wine in the complexity of flavors and aromas and things that go on. And people really do get iced tea a little bit wrong. And just to belabor a point more than anyone thought I could, and everyone knows I can belabor
a
point.
Francis, because we were going to talk about iced tea for about 45 seconds.
Is that horse dead yet? Here's the other thing, a magic ingredient you should have in your home, is when you're sweetening iced tea, rather than use sugar, which problem is when you use sugar, you stir your granular sugar into your iced tea, right? And you're left with granular sugar at the end, and you have a little sweet spot on the bottom. If you take 1-to-1 proportions, sugar and water, preferably hot water. I like to boil the water. I like to get used filtered water. You can make what's called simple syrup. That sugar will stay suspended in that water. You basically have sugar water. And what we do at the restaurant is rather than serve sugar with our iced teas, we'll serve a little pitcher of simple syrup, and that goes
Just sugar solution, and water, again, as Francis said.
And it goes in right into solution. It stays in solution, and it will sweeten your iced coffee or your iced tea without those nasty granular flakes.
It can also sweeten your homemade lemonade. And that's something that I strongly recommend.
No fructose.
Lemonade is really easy to make. All you need to do is squeeze some fresh lemons, add some simple syrup, water, ice, lemonade. Spectacular.
We're going to give you a recipe for lemonade and talk to you about why homemade is best after the show. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Oscar Schofield of Rutgers University about red tide that has been affecting the Northeast this season. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we're here with Professor Oscar Schofield from the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University. And we're going to talk a little bit about the red tide, not just the one that affected Cape Cod last month, but some of the red tides that are affecting us across the East Coast this year. And it's been kind of a bad year for that. Welcome to the show, Professor Schofield. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Very well.
Thanks for coming to join us. Now, what happened? We read a lot of articles about this red tide. Well, first of all, will you tell us what a red tide is?
Yeah, no problem. If you go to the ocean, the phytoplankton are the plants of the ocean. Unlike trees on land, phytoplankton are very small, about 100 microns. So a tree in the ocean is about 100 microns in size. There's many, many types of plants in the ocean, it's much more diverse than on land.
Right.
And a very small group of them have particularly bad effects for humans.
Uh-huh.
There's a group that are toxic.
Uh-huh.
They have neurotoxins. They have a whole suite of toxins, and they bloom all over the world.
Uh-huh.
At different intensities. And if you're a human,
I am.
And you get and
all right, listen up. If you're a human,
yeah. Well, I'm a professor, so I'm not. But if you're exposed to it, it can have a range of effects.
Now, when you say a bloom, what happens is all these
yeah.
these concentrate in one area and then bloom together, and then you have a red tide.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and, you know, it's like what a red tide refers to when you have a bloom of the specific kind of plant that's bad for humans.
Okay. Now, we had a big one of these that just happened off the coast of New England this spring. It was one of the worst in years. Am I correct?
That is correct.
How was that different than in prior years and than it usually is?
What made this year particularly bad was this sort of the spatial extent.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much have red tides up in New England probably every year.
Right.
But the one that made this one particularly bad was how far it spread and how long it lasted.
Now, let me just explain to our listeners. You have a lot of different kinds of red tide, and sometimes, you know, in Florida, of course, they have these terrible red tides that emit toxic gases, and they're very toxic to people who swim or even people who live in those coastal areas. This isn't the kind of red tide we're talking about. We had up in New England a red tide, and why we're on the Restaurant Guys radio show talking about it. This was a tide that it affected the bivalves. It affected the shellfish. And, of course, the shellfish from New England in the summertime in June, the Wellfleet oysters were affected. All the clam beds were affected.
It's such a huge market, and that's their prime time of year.
And so if you didn't see Wellfleet oysters on the market at all, or clams on the market at all. And this was tremendous. Why does it affect, Professor Schofield, why does it affect only the bivalves?
Well, what happens is the bivalves are sitting there, and essentially the way they eat is they're filtering a lot of the water and sucking everything, all the plankton out of it.
Uh-huh.
And most of the plankton are the plants.
Right.
Now, these plants have a paralytic toxin in them. And what's happening is...
Going to have to stop you there. You said paralytic toxin.
Yeah.
So if we wind up eating one of these shellfish or someone unawares, you die.
You can get... If you get a large enough dose of it, you die.
So this is a very serious thing.
Yeah.
And
so... What happens is, I mean, if you drank a cup of seawater, I mean, other than tasting gross, it wouldn't kill you. But with the mussels and all this, they're actually concentrating the toxin inside their tissue.
Wow. So now, when you say you die, because that always really gets my attention when everybody says that.
Do this, you die. Yeah, that's.
Are we talking like one oyster and you die?
Probably not one oyster, but if you were to eat a plate of oysters with the strain that was growing up in New England, you would not be doing well.
Yes. I'm sorry to be so morbid, but I really am fascinated. Now, when say I eat half a dozen of these oysters, do I...
So suppose you went to some illegal shellfish place and they went and...
They smuggled you.
red tide laced things, and you ate a bunch.
Yeah.
The first sign you might be having issues is you might get strong tingling of the lips.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness!
And sort of, and you would start sort of feeling a numbness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then your head would explode. But
she had me right there.
But
all right, you had me at hello, Doc. Yeah.
But so essentially, you know, you can get a dose. And you might feel some general symptoms, and it won't wipe you out. You know, it's all a question of degree and how much of the toxin you ingest. And the fish, I mean, the mussels concentrate so much of it.
Right.
So when it's a real toxic critter that's blooming, you don't need to eat too much to really be hurt. And so that's why when these outbreaks happen, a lot of the states have really sort of set up systems to monitor the shellfish and everything like that so that they can shut down
the
mussel beds. And what will happen is after the bloom dies, and if you give it time, you might slowly clear the toxin out of the mussel.
Will cooking do anything for you?
No.
Nothing at all?
No. It's like if it's a laced toxin, you know, mm-hmm. you're just, you shouldn't eat it. It's kind of like, you know, when they talk about ciguatera fish poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Hold on a second. We're going to talk about ciguatera fish poisoning. How appetizing is that?
When we come back, delighted.
We're here. We're talking with Professor Oscar Schofield from the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University about red tide and how it affects us here in the East Coast and how your head might explode. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. Back to The Restaurant Guys. We're here today talking to Professor Oscar Schofield, who's an associate professor of oceanography at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. And we are talking about red tide, which has affected the Northeast and some of the kind of the creepy things that can happen. This stuff is pretty serious. Dr. Schofield, did this used to happen and people get caught unawares and then the first time, because not all red tides are visible, like the first time that people would know about it in colonial times would be when, you know, someone ate an oyster and their head exploded and they'd say, okay, no more oysters for a while?
Yeah, no, it's been around forever. They're actually very old organisms on Earth.
But,
and if you actually go to, like, old sort of Native American sort of descriptions, like in Washington State and everything, they would talk about certain bays where you wouldn't eat food. And the reason was there was a higher probability of that food being toxic.
But
the thing that's changing, though, is there's a lot of debate in the science community, because there's some evidence that might suggest that sort of the frequency of red tides is increasing.
Well, that's kind of scary to think that it's increasing. Now, obviously, this has been around for a long, long time. I know that it's been studied, and it's red tides have been around a lot longer than man has been around. But it's the fact that it's increasing should scare us a little bit. What do you think the causes to that?
Well, I mean, it's like, again, it's a question of debate. Maybe, you know, but essentially, we know that humans are slowly altering sort of the nutrient chemistry of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we have a lot of fertilizer from the heartland.
But our fertilizer's nowhere near the ocean. It's in the heartland, just like you said.
It still will go into watersheds or transported through the atmosphere and essentially end up in the ocean.
And again, this is Professor Schofield, I know you're in the listening area, so you hear this from us all the time. This is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about when we talk in other shows where we talk about sustainable agriculture and not over-fertilizing and not beating up the land. There are ramifications to these things which are not just, okay, we're going to shut down this field for 2 years because it's dead and it needs to be revitalized.
Yeah. No, it's like I would say that if you look at sort of how the Earth functions, humans have changed. They have changed the nitrogen cycle of Earth.
Right.
And the way that impacts in the ocean is nitrogen is fertilizer in the ocean just like it is on land.
And it can fertilize the pathogens and the bad things as
well.
Yeah,
and sometimes what happens is it's kind of like, you know, you over-fertilize.
Professor Schofield, we have to take a short break for the news, but when we come back, I want to talk to you more about exactly how this happens and what the implications are for us and our food chain and how we live here on the planet. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with my partner Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or just through restaurantguysradio.com.
Hi there, Mark.
Hey.
We are here talking today with Professor Schofield, Professor Oscar Schofield, who is an associate professor of oceanography at the Institute for Marine and Coastal Services at Rutgers University, and we're talking about red tide. Before we broke for the news, Professor Schofield, you were talking to us about how human beings are sort of changing the nitrogen cycle of life on the planet, and that's sort of maybe one of the things that's contributing to an increasing occurrence of red tide throughout the world and throughout the United States and our region. What exactly were you saying about that?
So essentially, the main point is humans, by essentially modifying the nitrogen cycle, are effectively dumping more nitrogen into the ocean.
Okay.
It's through the atmosphere. It's not like just a simple clean up a sewage pipe type of thing. And what happens is if you change the amount of nitrogen to other chemicals in the ocean, you might favor one plant versus another. You know, so you know, certain soils favor redwood trees and certain soils favor ferns. So the idea is that as we change the chemistry of the ocean, perhaps we're slowly changing it where it favors some of these harmful algae.
Well, in reading about this, I noticed that that's not, that may not be the only way we're affecting this.
So that's one way. Mm-hmm. Another way that has been documented is in ballast water.
Right.
So you have ships when will suck in a bunch of water from a bay and then steam to another place on the earth. And
so for instance, a ship is off the port of Europe.
Yep.
Sails to the United States, it has ballast water in it from Europe.
And then it dumps that water, you know, in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's carrying any critters, the ballast water, it's now seeded a new place of the ocean.
Where there may not be the predators for
which may not have the ecosystem.
And so I think that's been documented a lot more in, like, Asia and New Zealand and stuff like that.
Now, let me ask you, it strikes me that water is water. Now, couldn't that ship very cheaply just exchange its port ballast water way out in the middle of the ocean for more neutral middle of the ocean water before it came into a new port?
It probably could, but it's also a very expensive proposition, and it has to do, if you've got a container ship that's loaded to the hilt,
right?
You don't want to be fiddling with your ballast. You know, when you're away from land.
Because sinking could be an issue.
Yeah, like slipping over in a ship just sucks.
You don't want to tip over a heavily laden car.
So I know that, like, the industry's really, you know, looking at it, but I don't think anyone has really come up with a good solution yet.
There was one other potential cause for this that really fascinated me. And I know that there's a fish out there that most of us have never heard of, which, we are depleting for reasons that are kind of peculiar, and I'd love for you to talk about menhaden fish and kind of what we've done to the stocks of the menhaden fish and how that's affecting.
Yeah, so, well, menhaden is essentially a small fish, and it used to be one of the major fisheries along the northeast here. Mm-hmm. So if you go down to, like, Tuckerton or southern Jersey, you'll often see these old sort of abandoned fish factories, and there used to be menhaden factories.
Now, really? Menhaden's not a fish we would eat, so why is it fished?
Well, there a lot of the fisheries were for making fish meal to feed cows and stuff like that. And it was when those schools were huge, it's a very easy way to just suck it up. So, you know, a lot of fish very easily, and it's cheap.
It always alarms me whenever I hear a professor of oceanography talk about when those schools were plentiful.
Yeah.
I assume the past tense means that they are no longer.
Many of the fisheries on the planet have been very severely depleted. If you think about it, we farm everything except for fish, and the salmon is the only thing we really farm,
right.
Maybe trout. And we're still hunters when it comes to fish. And the thing about humans is we're really good hunters.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you look at every single big fish globally, there's a few reports that came out, you can essentially see the depletion of every major big fish in the world's ocean. So for the red tide, the issue is if there are specific fish that eat the red tide or
eat plankton, red tide's a kind of plankton.
Excuse me?
The red tide is a kind of plankton.
Exactly. And so if you alter the food web, you might take away the grazing pressure that kept the red tide in check before.
Mm-hmm. Now, it say red tide. Are they always red, Doc?
No, I mean, they actually look just like scum.
My partner looks a little like scum.
Yeah, I mean, they call me the scum guy in my lab. But essentially,
everybody needs a title.
But they will occasionally, what some of these red tides do is they swim, and they swim right up to the surface.
Now, hold on a second. What do you mean they swim?
Yeah, they've got little flagella. And they can swim about, you know, not all of them, but some of them can swim up to 8 meters in a day.
Really?
And so what they do is often, especially like off Florida, what they'll do is when they're blooming, they'll swim up to the surface during the day, and then they get all the sunlight, and they photosynthesize. And then at night, they swim down deep where all the nutrients are. And so the reason they call them red tide is when they're up at the surface, they form this really concentrated slick that takes on a reddish color.
Wow.
So when you have a really extreme one, They have some really dramatic ones occasionally off California where the water looks blood red.
Oh, my God. And so this is swimming scum.
Swimming scum.
That's really bad. Toxic
swimming scum.
Right. Let's go back to Cape Cod. Are those fish beds open again now?
The last I checked was they were still closed, but I haven't checked in the last few days. And everyone was just sort of shocked at the scale of it.
Right.
And so I know that, like, they had filed, a lot of the fisheries up there actually tried to file for disaster relief.
Uh-huh. Did they get
FEMA,
it?
FEMA, and they were turned down because there's really, that would be sort of a new precedent to set. And so they... I think the local communities up there are still dealing with it.
I mean, the devastation to the restaurants and the fisheries and the tourist industry is just really terrible. Now, this red tide up in the Northeast, that affected only the bivalves. Is that how red tides usually work? We've read about the ones in Florida that actually affect people. I mean, people on land.
Yeah,
how does that
work? So the one on Florida, they're kind of cool. They swim up.
We have different definitions of cool.
Our professor.
Professor of marine biology.
But the ones in Florida are very soft. They have soft bodies.
Uh-huh.
And what will happen is,
me too.
Is when the wind blows and there's waves, they'll break.
Uh-huh.
And the neurotoxin gets into the water, and it volatilizes in gas and then bubbles out of the ocean and hits the beaches.
Neurotoxin gets out of the water and bubbles out and hits the beaches.
Yeah, and so the way we generally monitor for the red tides there, and they have a bloom every year. They've had one going on for the last 4 months.
Wow.
And it's a neurotoxin, so it causes respiratory irritation and stuff like that.
This is for people on land.
Yeah, and so you'll essentially know that there's a red tide either by massive fish kills or a lot of people are showing up at the doctor with sort of a respiratory issue. And, there's a red tide, so we got to go out there and try to figure out what's going on.
What happens to the fish?
They are killed by the toxin.
Yeah.
And you'll have massive fish kills and manatee kills. So one year there was a MIG red tide down in Florida, and I think it was something like 20% of the manatee population was wiped out in a month.
Wow.
And what happens if you eat one of these fish by mistake? Now, I know the bivalves are filters, so they're gathering a lot of this. But what happens if you eat one of these sick fish?
I think that one will affect you, but I think it won't be. It's not as toxic as the ones up in New England. But usually it's like when they're sick, they're those sort of bloated, floating kind on top of the water.
Right.
So, you're not going to.
Yeah, you're going to say, I don't think.
Yeah,
usually
the issue there is it looks so gross with all the dead fish on the beach that it becomes a tourism issue and all that type of stuff.
Time for steak. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Professor Oscar Schofield, who is an associate professor of oceanography at the Institute for Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University, and we've been talking about red tides and how it affects our diet.
And how really, really scary they can be. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And one of the things that we have to remember is that we are having an effect on the planet, and we're having effects on the planet in ways that we don't realize exactly how the chain of events occurs. And we could be adding to this, and we need to be very careful about that. And I want to talk more about that in just a moment when we come back.
I want to talk about Prince Edward Island 1987 when we come back.
Extraordinary. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 11:45. Back with The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Professor Oscar Schofield of Rutgers University about red tides.
Professor Schofield, we have in 87, and I alluded to this right before we went to break, Prince Edward Island had a crazy outbreak of red tide, or algae bloom at least. Was that a red tide as well?
I think so. I'm actually not positive.
Okay. Well, what kinds of bad things happened there?
Essentially, up in that area, they do have a lot of red tides.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was one this summer up there. And it's the same type of issue where you essentially have a lot of the shellfish essentially concentrating the toxin.
I remember that back then there were people who reported cases of temporary amnesia as a result of
the toxins. Oh, yeah. So, okay. So there's a class of, like, 10 or 12 toxins, that are sprinkled between the algae. And so there's one type of toxin called domoic acid.
Uh-huh.
And the most famous cases occurred off
Santa Cruz. It sounds scary,
Santa
domoic
Cruz.
Acid.
Yeah. And, essentially it's a temporary amnesic, It has amnesia effects on you.
How mean, like, you forget who you are?
It's more the short-term memory. So you might actually forget that wonderful shellfish meal you just ate before.
I was just about to say, do you forget that you shouldn't be eating shellfish, and then you eat more shellfish?
Then you die. And then your head explodes. We didn't realize how frequently it occurred until they started looking. There was an outbreak.
People forget to report.
Yeah. And generally the way you find that one is it kills a lot of the birds, the seabirds.
Mm-hmm.
So like off California.
They forget how to fly.
I guess they fly into
trees and stuff.
But you'll find a lot of like dead pelicans or seals or stuff like that. And part of the issue is it's like, well, maybe the red tides have always been there in the concentration they are now, but we're getting good to finally find them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to play devil's advocate, that's what they would argue. But the more we look, the more we find them, and we're finding them in areas that we didn't before, which is why people think that things might be changing.
You know, one of the things that was very interesting, if you look at the history of New York especially, so many of these cities used to have oyster sellers that would just walk around with oysters on carts and sell them. That was a way for a poor person to make a living. Actually, oysters and in parts of the country, lobsters were always considered like the poor man's food, like rich people wouldn't eat them. And people would sell oysters from oyster carts throughout New York City. And a little thing called cholera really made people stop that. What is the relationship of cholera in oysters? Does that have to do with the red tide?
No, that would be a bacteria in the water, you know, and so it's just another thing that might just wipe you out. I mean, if you look at, like, shellfish, like in the Mid-Atlantic Bight, there was all the big oyster beds in Long Island Sound, and then in the 80s they had what was called a brown tide, you know, and so it was more brownish than red.
And
it pretty much wiped out the shellfish stalks, not making them toxic, but killed them, and it took almost a decade for them to come back.
Wow. So what's happening now off the coast of New Jersey with these red tides? And
there's a few little brown tide outbreaks here or there. You know, I've just sort of heard through the grapevine. And then, you know, it's not red tide. There's a bacterial outbreak that they were closing some shellfish beds, you know, to the south and everything like that. I mean, for some reason, New Jersey, I mean, we have red tides or this or that, but we don't have them, you know, as frequently as, like, New England does or Florida does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might just be that Jersey water is just a little bit tougher.
I don't know if everybody... I don't know if everybody realizes, but when a restaurant or a fishmonger buys shellfish, it comes with a tag, and you're required by law to keep that tag for a full year in case there's some type of foodborne outbreak from that shellfish because of all the possible problems there could be. They need to be able to track that shellfish directly to the bed that from which it came.
Well, and one of the things that I think we want to point out to people is we are talking about the red tide, and we're talking about some of the things that we're finding that are going wrong with shellfish. One of the most wonderful foods in the world, if you love it, and it's a love or hated food, are raw oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And I adore them. I will go out of my way to have them late at night on the way home. There's a place not too far from my house. It's right in New York City called Blue Ribbon, where I go and I get raw oysters often at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I think that one of the things that we need to remind our listeners of is that the incidence of people getting sick from oysters is much lower now than it's ever been.
That's true.
Because we are monitoring things so very, very closely.
I mean, I have to say, you know, the federal and state agencies do an amazing job.
Well, we also have the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences watching our back.
You know, it's like, you know, the science studs are out there. but I mean, I grew up in California, so you'd always go harvest mussels and make great stews and everything like that. And you just sort of learned that there were certain months you didn't harvest
shellfish.
So is it like the old diet's dinner quote? Oyster is unseasonable and unwholesome in months that have not the letter R in the
name. Right, exactly.
And essentially, those months have a higher probability of having red tide in the water.
Interesting.
And so when I grew up, you know, in Southern California, it's like you just knew that these months you could go pick, and these other months you didn't. And occasionally someone would pick at the wrong month and get toasted.
And then it would remind you all not to do it the next time. Hey, listen, Oscar, we want to thank you so much for joining us to talk about Red Tide with us today and taking the time out of your busy schedule.
I think you shed a lot of light on this for
anytime,
us.
Anytime you got a scum problem, give me a call.
You'll be our scum guy.
I'll
You'll be a scum,
the scum
go-to
guy.
That's Professor Oscar Schofield from Rutgers University. He's an associate professor of oceanography at the Institute for Marine and Coastal Sciences, shedding the light on Red Tide with us. We'll be back in just a moment to talk with you more about shellfish and your summer barbecue and the kinds that you should eat and be
maybe something
at
a little more appetizing.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Mark Pascal and Francis Schott, Restaurant Guy. Today we were talking about Red Tide with Professor Oscar Schofield from the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. You know that we got introduced to Dr. Schofield by one of our employees who's a marine biologist, Beth Logan, who gave me a two-hour class on Red Tide last night so we could be better prepared for our show.
Thank you, Beth Logan.
Yes, very much.
Really super.
He really was great.
Can we talk about positive things rather than red tide and disease?
You know, what I was going to say is one of the things, and you've actually been out there with me to my aunt's house out she lives out on Long Island, and one of my absolute favorite things to do is go out and mussel and clam out there and bring that food to the table, give the clams a couple hours to clean themselves out. We actually used to pour cornmeal in the water so the clams and or mussels could clean themselves out, and we'd leave them in there in the seawater for a little while and let them clean themselves out with cornmeal in the water, and they would take in the cornmeal and get out all the dirt that was in them.
Do you know one of the things I love doing is going out to your aunt's house in Long Island. They have a beautiful house and a great little kitchen garden, and you and your uncle go out and clamming, and I sit in the boat and have a beer, and then and then your aunt makes the clams really tasty good, and then I have another beer. Oh, it's back to nature for me.
My absolute favorite meal when I'm out there is the crabs with tomato sauce with marinara sauce and spaghetti. It's just perfect. You just take the whole crab, you saute them right in the tomato sauce. Unbelievable. Cut them into four. Get yourself all gooey. Nothing better than that.
Also, I think people are intimidated by oysters sometimes. Oysters are fairly expensive. Best source locally for oysters is Maddie on East Brunswick Fish Market.
Absolutely.
Again, oysters, we've talked about some of the things that can go wrong with oysters. They're really some of the best food in the world. And the way to have them, my favorite way to have them, you just put them on the grill, and then they open themselves up. Opening an oyster is really a skill, and you can really cut your hand on it, and you need a special knife for it. Or you can just sit them on the grill and the heat until they just open up and they still have the liquor in them, and you take them and you eat them warm, and there's nothing like a warm oyster on the
grill. There really isn't. You know, if you're a real oyster fan, too, they have those chainmail gloves you can buy and save yourself perhaps an injury.
But you still need a lot of skill to open those up, so, hey, don't try this at home. Hey, you spent another hour talking about shellfish today with the Restaurant Guys. I hope you've enjoyed our little discussion.
I have.
Excellent, Mark. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.